WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
My guest is actress Ruby Dee. She's been an important presence on stage and screen for over 40 years. Ruby Dee has also been an active participant in the civil rights movement, along with her husband, actor Ossie Davis. She's been associated with nearly every major national civil rights group, from the NAACP to the Black Panthers. Ruby Dee began her acting career with the American Negro Theater, where she first met Sidney Poitier. They co-starred in five films, including A Raisin in the Sun, Edge of the City, and Buck and the Preacher. On stage, she was the first Black actress to perform with the American Lena. Ruby Dee and Ossie Davis recently hosted a public television series called With Ossie and Ruby. Ruby Dee has also written a new book of poems and short stories. It's titled My One Good Nerve. Ruby Dee, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
Were you exposed to much theater as a child?
No, not that much. Not really that much. But I did, we lived in a very rich community and Harlem, I grew up in Harlem. And on Saturdays we wrote poetry in the library, and we had music lessons, and we took dancing lessons, and like all the children at that time did, everybody had a piano or something. Not everybody, but most everybody. By the way, when you read that introduction,
yeah.
I don't know that I was the first at the Shakespeare Festival to work there. But you must have some other kind of information.
Well,
but
all your official bios seem to indicate that, so I don't know.
I figure they've done their research well.
Yeah,
not the first, but I don't know about that.
Okay.
But at any rate, so in a sense, I had a richness there, and my mother was a teacher. My mother.
Now, I had read about your mother, by the way, that she really pushed you to the fine arts.
Yes, she herself had wanted to be an actor.
Ah,
yes, yeah. And she'd worked with Richard B. Harris in The Green Pastures, and she had and she'd been a teacher and all that,
Well, when you started acting, this was in the 1940s, there was still segregation in the South.
Mm-hmm.
And I figure a lot of avenues that were open to young white actors who were breaking into stage and screen were probably not open to young Black actors.
Yes, you're probably right.
Yeah, I'm probably right.
Yes, and that's true. And it has brought something to my attention that at some point in every Black person's life, you come to reckon with the fact that you're Black and things are different for you.
Was that when it happened to you, when you were first starting to act?
Well, no, not really. Because I remember reading the magazines and thinking, oh, I was going to be like the starlets coming along that I read about. They get a 7-year contract and they go to Hollywood and they make grade B movies and they have all their troubles, and sometimes they go on then to have contracts and be playing regular movies. Well, it didn't dawn on me for a while that wouldn't happen to me, that would. And the thing I learned from that experience is that there's an insidious growth in your consciousness. There's a cancer in the consciousness that begins to grow that stems from racism in our country. And you're not aware of it until it's there in your psyche, and it begins to limit and inhibit and destroy self-confidence and make you not as daring as you would like to be, or as bold and as... And you have to really learn how to be confident, and to acclaim yourself for yourself. That's the insidious part of it. I think that's what's happening too in the cities with the crime business. I think not enough attention is paid to Blackness. We're not paying attention to the phenomenon of racism, so I think when young people get hold of that, when it finally dawns on them, it's a shattering experience. You go all kinds of crazy ways,
Well, you got started at the American Negro Theater. Is that what it was called?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, was that a place where you could do the kinds of roles that you were perhaps not going to be able to get in the largely white world of theater?
I hadn't been able to compare it then, but it was just a marvelously exciting time at the American Negro Theater. We, this place in the basement of the library in 135th Street. And as I look back now at those people who started at Abram Hill and Fred O'Neill, and Oh, it's with the dreams, hard dreams that propel them to Harlem from the universities into this. My respect for them deepens and grows. You take it for granted when you go there, but so yes. What were you saying?
If you were able to do the kinds of serious roles there that you might not have been able to get as a black actress on stage or screen.
Yes, well, but at that point there was no competition. I was there, and whatever came up during my time there that I was eligible for, I read and got it. I didn't think about anything else in terms of theater and film. Then the entertainment world began to come to the American Negro Theater. I mean, the first movie I ever did for the government was cast from the American Negro Theater. The first Broadway play that I was associated with stemmed from there, and that play Anna Lucasta, that starred Hilda Sims.
You met your husband there too, didn't
no,
you?
No, I met him in another play called Jeb, which was shortly after that. And then Harry Wagstaff Gribble from England, an English director, came down to the American Negro Theatre, and he directed Anna Lucasta, and he brought it to Broadway. And it was a time when we attracted all kinds of teachers and black and white. And I think about Osceola Archer and Benjamin Samak and Curtis Cooksey and so many that came there. It was like a marvelous university in that basement where we studied acting and speech and dance, movement and writing. And I think about, knowing Abe, I hadn't realized how much until now, you know, he's going, what a marvelous thing that those dreamers did, you know. I mean, for it doesn't matter what race, it's just at that point. And also they spawned a lot of people like, gave birth to others who started theater groups like Barbara Antier and Roger Furman and
Lloyd Richards.
Lloyd Richards, yes, was associated there, and so many, you know, that group touched.
Let me reintroduce you for our listeners just joining us. Actress Ruby Dee is my guest. Now, you met your husband Ossie Davis when you were performing in Jeb.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you were playing opposite each other, is that right?
No, I started in that show as an understudy.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. The producer. Do you have the name of the producer there?
No, I don't. I'm sorry.
Oh, anyway. it slips my mind right now. But this was a play that had we'd known was going to be done, and I was thinking about some other people that from the American Negro Theater that I thought would be right for that part. But as it turned out, Ossie was from another group, the Rose McLennan Players, through Dick Campbell and his wife Muriel at the time. So we both came from groups, but we met outside of the group at this first professional thing that both of us did.
Mm-hmm. So I had this image of you playing opposite each other and
well, no,
and falling
I got
in love.
I got the part. I did, but that was part of it.
Uh-huh.
Because the girl that they had doing it for some reason was let go, and I, being the understudy, I stepped into the role before it opened on Broadway.
Oh, so this is really starting to sound like a movie. So,
well, but in a sense, it was. I guess I don't know, but I did really get connected to my husband during that show.
So you were playing opposite each other. For
yes, we did. Mm-hmm.
I've always figured it must be very easy and, in a way, tempting to fall in love with someone who you're playing opposite with in a play.
Yes, I suppose I think so. Especially when you're young and new at the business, because that and especially when you have all kinds of insecurities and. But I think even above and beyond our meeting in this particular show, I would have been connected to my husband. I think it was like one of those quote, we were just meant to be.
Right.
You know? And I remember watching him on stage as I hadn't started playing with him then,
mm-hmm.
and thinking to having a very strange reaction as I watched him. And that made me pay attention to my reaction because I hadn't really focused on him until that. Like it was like a sudden moment, you know, that I paid attention to him because I had been sitting in the theater, kind of laughing at him with a friend of mine. Because I said he's so skinny, my God, and he gets these suits from the Salvation Army, you know, and he was like a pole in a big hole. and beanpole.
I want to ask you about another actor who played a significant part in your life, and I'm thinking of Sidney Poitier. You ended up co-starring in around, I don't know, like five movies together about.
Oh, yes, and then our families were great friends, and we still are. His ex-wife is one of my best friends.
Now, how did it work out that you co-starred in five movies? Were you almost like a package together?
No. I don't really know how that came about, because we were just in the group together. I liked Sidney, and, you know, we've always been like a family. He's been like a brother to me. Like my husband and Sidney and Sidney's wife, and we were all, the four of us were a neat group at the time, and we spent a lot of time in each other's homes and at each other's tables and in each other's kitchens and arguing and talking and discussing. And so, but I don't know how it was that we got put together in so many things. But I must say that most of the things that I worked in with Sidney were plays about men, you know, about when he was a basketball player and won. And, you know, I mean, I did the woman role.
What do you mean by that, the woman role?
In terms of my relationships, in most of the films I've done, you know, the wife, the girlfriend, the one left
the long-suffering.
The long-suffering, the one yearning and pulling and rooting and, you know, much like the relationships of black to white, you know, the existence is important only as it relates to the other, you know. It wasn't about the characters that I played as a rule. It was about the men that I was playing with.
Well, you know, one kind of like classic.
And still is, as a matter of fact.
Is it true?
About a play I'm doing now. The most important thing is, in this play, is my relationship to the husband. You know, the fact that I'm a nurturer and a protector and a rooter.
So this has been a source of frustration for you throughout your career.
Well, it's not frustration. It's just,
Right.
I've had to think about that.
You know, one kind of
but there's a greater awareness now among women, so many kinds of things, like through people like Gloria Naylor and Bambara and Rogai and so many of the writers and Morris.
But of course, they're not writing for movies, not that I know of.
Yeah, but I want them to.
Right.
And I want that. That's why I want to have to be a millionaire one of these days, so I can get these films done. I spent 2 years, for example, breaking down books, doing screenplays as best I could for around three novels, you know, just and trying to interest, you know, and get them, those things started. And I feel sure that will happen.
While we're talking about roles for women, mm-hmm. one kind of classic role for women, for black women, has been the long-suffering mother or grandmother,
mm-hmm.
you know, the very bosomy maternal figure.
Yes.
And this is a role that, to my knowledge, you haven't played, that kind of.
The maternal, well.
And the older, big, you know, there's a certain kind of body
like,
one has to have.
Like
that.
Mama in Raisin,
mm-hmm.
that kind of thing.
That's right, yeah.
No, I haven't done that, but I've been asked if I wanted to do Mama. And the thing is, I'd like to do Mama, but from a different kind of different perspective. Because that is that woman has a life and a longing and an aspiration and a thrust that few writers dare to explore, you know. And I think often mamas become mamas out of frustration, you know, the big bosom. They become cushions and solace places for their families and for their neighbors and for the world, because nobody's paying attention to them and they have nowhere to cry.
It seems to me you've usually gravitated toward serious roles in dramas. I'm just curious, were you ever offered, and I know this has happened to so many black actors, the role of the maid in a movie?
Oh, God, yes. My first television thing I did is something I think called The First Year. And I remember this. I don't know why it stuck with me all these years. But I go into the kitchen, and the lady of the house says to me, "Hattie, did you seed the melons?" And I says, "Oh, yes, I seed them." And she says, "I mean, did you take the seeds out?" And I said, oh, does she do that? They're telling me about Maisie. I guess, but I've done other kinds of roles too, like in Campanella's Wife. That was a different kind of role, and also Long Day's Journey.
But did you ever say no to roles that you thought were...
Yes, and I've said no to some things that I'm sorry I did say no to, because later, I've discovered that you have to say yes to life, and you have to say yes often in circumstances, because you might be able to move in there and make a difference somewhere. You don't always have to agree thoroughly with something that you do. I always had a kind of feeling, well, it wasn't honest of me if I really didn't like this or really didn't agree with it to be part of it. But often the only way you sometimes an opportunity presents itself, and it's sudden and it's unexpected, or it's you can't always judge.
Well, I guess another trade-off too is that maybe you don't like the role, but the director's really interesting to work with, or something like that. That there's some other reason why it might be interesting to do.
And certainly not because of fear. So, for instance, I was asked to direct a piece. I never forget Cosby once, when he was doing his show, asked me to come and direct. Suddenly, this was a sudden call, and often our blessings come in sudden ways. And I'd never directed a television show, and I couldn't imagine why he was asking me, but it was in a sense. The way things happen suddenly, I think you have to be alert to the inner voices and the guidance and the ways you pray for. Sometimes the answer doesn't come just because you can predict it. And I says, oh no. And he says, well, I'll help you. I'll be with you. And I said, oh, I don't think I can. I've never directed anything.
So did you do it?
No, I didn't.
Oh,
because you see, I never did that.
So you think of that as a missed opportunity?
Yes. And I don't lament. It didn't occur to me until later. Oh, that's how prayers are answered. That's how requests. This is how you grow. Sometimes it's unexpected
And scary.
And scary.
Yeah.
And sometimes you don't do that, and it stays with you. Like I was on my way to the bank once.
Yeah. Go ahead.
And I met this woman, and she wanted me. They were having a party in a senior citizen's house, and she wanted me to come up there and do a recitation. Oh, Ruby, I'm so happy I saw you. And I said, oh no, I can't. I've got to get. The bank is going to close, and I have to get there. Well, you know, that thing stayed with me so long, and I've been trying to get back. And I left word, please call me again. I got to the bank; it was closed anyway. Because by the time I talked to her, it was all, you know.
Well, I guess there's a lesson there.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is actress Ruby Dee. This is Fresh Air. Actress Ruby Dee is my guest. Now, throughout most of your career, you and your husband, Ossie Davis, have been really pretty active in the civil rights movement. And I guess that was especially true in the 50s and in the 60s. Mm. You were associated with fairly mainstream groups and also with some pretty radical groups.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if that political association ever affected your acting career, and if you ever felt that you were perhaps not offered certain roles or, you know, blacklisted in some way because of your association with the civil rights movement, especially with the more radical groups.
Well, maybe that could have been so, but we've never really seriously let that into our consciousness. It really never was a source of, you know, we've had some funny experiences, you know, during the McCarthy era, but it seems even so was so strange to be, you know, the Red Scare was pale in comparison to the Black Scare. You know, being Black in America is you know, 10 times worse than being red in America. As a matter of fact, you know, red goes in and out of fashion, and I suppose black does too. I don't know, but no, it may have done, and I'm sure it did in some. You know, we sent for some documents from the FBI. You know, you can do that.
Oh, the Freedom of Information Act.
Yes, and it was we howled.
What did you find? I don't remember now.
But we looked at this and we just howled. It seemed the most ridiculous thing. So of all the things that we've deeply not been able to take that seriously. I can't imagine not having known some of the people that we knew, you know, like Malcolm, like King, like some of the people that we met in the Free Southern Theater, and like some of the Panthers that we met, and Angela Davis. I mean, I can't imagine living in a life and being able to talk to such people and not, you know. There was I would be so much paler as a person hadn't I met those people and known about them, and the Eldridge Cleavers, as well as the Du Boises and the Robesons and the, because, as a matter of fact, the most exciting people in any society, I imagine, are the radicals. You know, they kind of keep the society moving.
Do you still feel that way as you get older?
Yes.
Some people who are very involved in radical activity when they're younger become more conservative or restrained as they get older.
Oh, yes. I think the most exciting people in the world are radical people, and you know, and who have ideas and who have passions. And as a matter of fact, any society coming along who doesn't have radicals ought to see if they can hire a few, hire them, you know. It's like Abernathy said about the washing machine. You know, what is a washing machine without an agitator? You know what I mean? I mean, I just think it's the most marvelous thing to have these kinds of groups in our midst. And to squelch them in any way, I think, damages, or to take those struggling for to prejudice.
How do you feel you've expressed that radicalism in your life and in your acting and political work?
I don't know. I suppose the best I can say of myself is I've tried to serve it, you know, in any way that I've tried to serve it. And also, it means thinking up new ways of, radical means thinking up new ways for society, for our fellow creatures to exist on this earth in better ways than they exist now. I like the idea of, you know, not... I suppose because there's something in me that is not radical, that is timid, that is lacks confidence.
That's the impression I get of that personally. You're very shy, but that as far as the world of ideas and politics, that you take a much more radical stance.
That's right. But I don't know myself that well yet because I used to have a very violent streak too, you know. And although I've never, I first met my husband. As a matter of fact, we went to a one of those galleries where you're shooting galleries, you know?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
And he'd just come out of he was a soldier, he'd just come out of the army. And so I remember my first, I don't know where I'd learned to shoot a gun, but I mean, I suppose there's a radicalism in me that knows that the way to change, you know, for radical and root changes is an organized and is not violence. But it's an appreciation for the necessity of forever bringing air into the, it's like a cake, you know.
Well this combination of shyness and radicalism seems to me like a perfect brew for acting. I mean, yeah. I'm thinking that a film director I interviewed recently, John Waters, said that he thought some of the best actors he worked with were really very shy off camera, but would just come alive when they were performing.
Yes.
So, you know, to have that kind of radical spirit, but to be a little shy, I could see that really working in your favor as an actress.
I think an epitome of that is Michael Jackson, for example. I think.
Well, he's in a category by himself when it comes to shyness.
because he has an astonishing expression of so much of everybody.
I want to ask you something again about early in your career. When you were young and newly married and you were bringing up your children, and from what I understand about you, it was hard for you to act then because you were busy as a mother.
Yes.
And then eventually you hired a housekeeper so that you could leave the house and perform when you wanted to.
That's right.
Was there a breaking point for you where you realized, I have to act? I mean, so we'll hire a housekeeper, we'll do something, I must act. I just can't stay home all the time.
Well, yes, and yes, there was. Because at first I thought, to marry my husband, I loved him so much. And I remember writing this, thinking, I would live anywhere, you know, it doesn't matter. You're in love, and to have the babies and everything. But it dawns on you, see, having a baby and being a mother are two different things, but you don't know that until after you have the baby. And because they don't teach you that in school, which I think should happen in school, by the way, you know, about motherhood and stuff. So it occurred to me one night when my husband's on the road, that I'm home with the babies and the diapers and the plumbing and stuff, and it occurred to me, and that there was a source of great tension, personal tension in my life, and fortunately, Arcee is my husband is sensitive to sensitive to things like that. So he insisted that I take acting classes and that I, you know, make moves outside the home. And thanks to relatives and friends, and eventually to people that we had to hire.
So you did it.
Right, we did it.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious. I haven't seen you in much in the movies lately. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if that's a conscious decision on your part.
I've been very busy, though. I've been doing, so for instance, 3 seasons we did with PBS, some of the most exciting work we've ever done with that mm-hmm. series. I mean, I can't say enough about that, some of that work, because I don't, and the writers that we had an opportunity to work with and so forth. And we were intercultural, interracial, and we dealt particularly with black writers. And I've finished a miniseries of, you know, The Winds of Change. And I did another one that was with Robert Wagner and Jacqueline Smith. And then I did a few months ago, I did a thing with Mary Tyler Moore and Sam Waterston called Lincoln, with Lamont Johnson, who was the director on that. And I'm doing books. I'm recording, you know. I'm trying to get a library going. I'm doing many things like that.
Well, speaking
and
of
I've,
books, yeah.
I've written a children's book for Henry Holt.
And speaking of books, I want to mention your new book, which is called My One Good Nerve. It's a collection of poems and short stories as mm-hmm. well. And Ruby Dee, we're out of time. I want to thank you so very much for talking with us. Thanks for being here.
We are. Oh, thank you.
Thanks for being here. Actress Ruby Dee has been my guest, and her new book again is called My One Good Nerve. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.